Today on Maine Calling, threats against public servants surge. How does this affect our democracy? Last year saw a rise in violence and intimidation of elected officials across the political spectrum. Three murders captured headlines, that of right-wing activist Charlie Kirk and of Democratic Minnesota State Legislator Melissa Hortman and her husband. Here in Maine, many officials have recently faced hostility and threats of violence, including 2nd District Congressman Jared Golden, Secretary of State Shenna Bellows, and State Representatives Deka Dallak and Katrina Smith. In her recent State of the Judiciary address, Maine's Chief Justice spoke of threats against judges. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we discuss the reasons for this atmosphere of intimidation and how it impacts government function. And we'll learn about efforts to protect local officials, judges, and election workers. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and Quarry Cottages at Highland Green, committed to providing low-maintenance living and dedicated to creating a community where residents are free to pursue their passions, and Bangor Savings Bank, committed to helping Northern New England communities thrive. You matter more. Bangor.com. And North Yarmouth Academy, a 2025 AP Platinum school recognized by College Board, inviting families to tour campus, shadow a student, and explore its new dormitory.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Political violence is nothing new in our nation's history. Just think of the duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. Today, duels don't happen, but threats to public officials are common, and recent studies show that they have been on the rise in recent years. Today, we're going to discuss threats and violence in politics and discuss what it means for our democracy. Our panelists today, Mark Brewer, who is professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Maine, and Jen Lancaster, deputy director with the League of Women Voters of Maine. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you think are the reasons for this threatening political atmosphere? Would you run for office? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you today. And Mark, I'll start with you. I mentioned the famous duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. And of course, we've had presidents assassinated. And, you know, we're thinking about just a few years ago, the horrible shooting of Gabby Giffords. But the studies I see, given this political violence is not new, the studies I see say that it's becoming more and more common for politicians to receive threats and intimidation and daily hostile interactions. What's going on?
Well, I think it's definitely clear that the level of threat that politicians, both elected and appointed, face today is higher than it has been at any other point in American history, at least based on the data we have. The question of why that is, I think, is a little bit more difficult to answer. I think part of that has to do with the overall levels of polarization that we have in our politics right now. I think part of it also has to do with the rise of social media. And then there's also part of it that has to do with the behavior and the rhetoric that we are seeing at some from the upper levels of American politics. But even with all of that being said, I think there's still a large part of the variance that's unexplained.
Okay. And we're talking, you and I, Mark, about elected officials. And this is where a lot of the focus has been. But Jen, you're looking at these threats in some other places as well. Where is it that League of Women Voters is paying attention to that somebody might not think of?
Sure. And I mean, that's a great question. Something that we've been doing for the last 6 years is we deployed nonpartisan volunteers to observe the polling locations, and we try to get into all 16 counties. Some of these are very small towns that no one seems to think about. But, generally speaking, they're all very quiet. But what we've heard anecdotally from town clerks is that, there's been a shift in the last few years where they do face physical threats, harassment, whether credible or not. And this has led to a much higher turnover. I'm just referencing my own town where I currently reside. In the last 3 to 4 years, we've had three town clerks. So this is a job that was once, I would say, a low key but pretty important municipal job that now you have to have some pretty thick skin to be able to get through an election day. So that is something that we've been observing the last 6 years. And yeah, I would say within that time, there's definitely been a shift.
So town clerks, and also voters themselves, right, Jen? You're hearing reports that people are threatened for showing up at polling places.
Sure, and this is something that we try to observe and be on the lookout for is, does a voter ever face threats of intimidation, which is illegal? Like everyone should be able to walk into a polling location, cast their ballot. It should be quick and easy, and that's it. So the things that we're looking for, is there ever an interference where a voter isn't able to cast their ballot because they face intimidation, because they face threats? Sometimes this is verbal, this is what we have witnessed on the ground, but we're able to be there to help assist that voter. But also, our town clerks, they are trained professionals. They are also looking out for these instances, and they're also always able to quickly correct when, situations like these occur so that voters are able to cast their ballot. And I would say, at the end of the day, that's the good news is that we have some pretty tough town clerks who are dedicated, they care about their job. At the end of the day, they just want to run smooth elections.
All right. Well, Mark, I want to talk about this increased atmosphere of political violence and what it means on a couple levels. One, I know a young woman who decided not to run for office, even though her mentor, a U.S. Congresswoman, encouraged her to because she didn't think she wanted to put her family at risk. We saw that Jared Golden is not running for re-election and acknowledged in part threats against his family. We're hearing that from others as well. If people are afraid for their families and therefore making the choice not to run for office or not to run for re-election, who is left?
That's a great question. There's researchers are still trying to get a handle on exactly how much of this is going on. We know that there's certainly some people who are choosing not to run because of this. I don't think we have a really good understanding of the magnitude, although my sense is it's probably quite large. If you tease that out, I suspect, again, this is not fully confirmed yet, but I suspect that your reasoning presents us with a situation where the people who choose to run are more likely to be on the extremes on each side, right? And we already knew that was the case in a heightened level of polarization that, and because of the direct primary system we use, we know that we tend to find more extreme candidates on both sides of the aisle and both parties running today than we did 30 or 40 years ago. But I think the threat of political violence is pushing that even further towards the extremes. Although, again, there's a certain amount of conjecture there, not as much empirical evidence as we will eventually have.
And Jen, I'm wondering if this means that we see people who do hold elected office maybe not be accessible to their constituents as they once were.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. The thing that we try to tell concerned voters that, maybe they have questions about election security and integrity, we tell them you can go straight to your town clerk and ask all of these questions. It's all open, it's all transparent. They should be able to have a conversation with that constituent. But, I think it would be actually highly unlikely that a town clerk would refuse a voter in that case because it's kind of part of the job, it's part of their duties. But it's something that it's hard to keep an eye on because Maine has over 400 municipalities. That's over 400 municipal clerks who are running elections. It's hard to know what's happening in all of these other small towns. So I think a question we have at the league is, if ever someone is on the ground and they witness this, we want to know about it so that we can work with them, we can get resources to that person, because this is what it takes to make sure our elections remain strong and open. But it also helps to dispel some of these common myths that a couple of folks become steeped in. It's like, let's just have an open conversation about this. We can talk about your concerns and help you get to a more comfortable place, and you understand this is how it works. Our elections are open. The laws are all right there online. You can read. And I think if we can do that as a community, we can get to a stronger place where people recognize that our elections are strong, they're accessible, they are open.
And Mark, what about accessibility to the elected representatives themselves? I think we're already seeing fewer things like town halls, and much more controlled environments. Do you believe that this is because of the atmosphere out there, and do you think it will become even more so in the future?
I think it's unfortunately yes on both counts. One of the hallmarks of America's representative democracy for years has been how easy it is for the average citizen to access their elected representatives, right? If we go back into, the early 19th century, it's one of the things that just absolutely stunned Tocqueville when he came to the United States. He couldn't believe it, right? How accessible elected officials were to their constituents. And that really remained true, throughout the 19th and into the 20th century. And one of the things we've seen very recently is exactly what you just described, that accessibility shrinking dramatically. And you can't really blame officials, right? When they're facing these kind of threats to both them and their family, it makes sense for them to dramatically decrease accessibility and to more tightly control the accessibility they do offer.
And if they are controlling accessibility, of course, that puts them further into a bubble, and I'm guessing less able to understand what their constituents might be going through.
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, that's another long-standing concern, in the American Republic. It's one, again, that I would say throughout the 19th century and a lot of the 20th century was one that, we were fortunate we didn't really have to concern ourselves with. I think today, that's no longer the case.
And how about, Mark, decisions that are made by legislators? I think it was very revealing last year when Lisa Murkowski admitted we are all afraid. I think she was talking about people who were Republicans and might be described as far right, but she's not the only one, and this is across the political spectrum. That she spoke out loud what a lot of people have not been willing to. We are all afraid. What does that mean for decisions made by the US Congress or even the state legislature?
Again, that's a answer. The answer to that question can only be provided by the decision makers themselves. But I strongly suspect that it's having an impact on the decisions that legislators, both at the federal and the state, and maybe even the local level, are making, right? When you're afraid of how people are going to react to an action you take, it's almost inevitable that that's going to affect your decision making, whether you're cognizant of it or not.
Yeah. Jen, what do we do about this?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, top of mind always for us is how can we support town clerks and our elections? And I mean, the number one thing that we can be doing is step up and serve as poll workers. Like, go actually out to your community, serve on the ground. You can actually witness the electoral process in action, and hopefully, it will be a pretty slow and quiet day because that's Maine. We're a small rural state. There's not always a lot going on. So stepping up, serving as, a poll watcher. You can also be a poll observer. You're just standing there, you're watching everything take place, and you can see that for the most part, people coming in, they're having a great time, they're casting their ballot. And at the end of the day, like, that's democracy in action. It's just people doing a quick and simple thing to be civically engaged.
All right. And Mark, we've seen arrests. We've seen arrests of people who've made threats. And I think in some ways it's easier for places like the FBI to investigate when people do those threats online and things like that. But what do you think is the answer? How do we simmer down? How do we bring this back to a place where democracy can not be affected by threats?
There's no real easy answer to that question, unfortunately. I think maybe the way that we might approach it is maybe some short-term and then some longer-term answers. I think short, maybe more immediate term, I think you kind of alluded to it, is increase security for elected officials, right? As much as we wish that weren't necessary, I think it's clear now that it is. And we're seeing that discussed in a lot of state legislatures and also at the federal level, increasing security for elected officials. I think longer term, maybe more difficult to achieve, is that we all need to take a step back and think about how we want to conduct ourselves in our representative democracy, right? That how do we want this to look? And I would suspect that most of us wouldn't want it to look the way it looks right now. So I think in that way, the answer, starts with us as a collective, but that's easier said than done. And also will take time to change the tone. We didn't get here overnight, and I don't think we get out of here overnight either.
We're talking about politics, threats of violence, violence, intimidation, and harassment, and its impact on our democracy. What are your thoughts about this? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're discussing threats to public servants from state and national level officials to school board members and poll workers. My guest today, Jen Lancaster, who is deputy director with the League of Women Voters in Maine, and Mark Brewer, University of Maine political science chair and professor. You can send a brief email to us at talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. On the line with us now is Maine Secretary of State Shenna Bellows. Secretary Bellows, thanks for calling in.
Hi there.
Earlier this year, you revealed that you were doxxed. For those people who don't know what that word means, doxxed, explain what it means and tell us what happened to you.
Doxing is when your personal information, like your cell phone and home address, are posted online with people being urged to attack the target. So my cell phone, my home address were posted. People said, let Secretary Bellows know, and I won't say what they said, but urged to call me. So I did. I got many calls from folks and even a death threat. Fortunately, law enforcement was right there for me. They increased patrols of my neighborhood and made me feel very safe. But it's designed to intimidate. It's designed to scare.
And this was not the first time you were subject to threats, correct?
Right. The first time it ever happened to me was more startling, back in December of 2023. After I made the decision that Trump wasn't eligible for the ballot, that elicited a lot of public response, but I was doxxed at that time, and then I was swatted. And, when I called my mom to say I'd been swatted, she said, "What's swatting?" And I was like, "Well, Mom, it's when someone makes a fake emergency call designed to elicit an emergency law enforcement response, a SWAT team response to your home." And similar to the doxxing, this time around, law enforcement was wonderful. I and my husband weren't home. They called me and said, "Are you home?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Is somebody at your house?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Well, we have to check this out." And I said, "Can you get my house keys instead of breaking down the door?" And to their credit, they did. They connected with my neighbors and went and got my house keys and did a sweep of my house, and everything was fine. But for a time, my husband and I had to live in a safe house during that period of time because of the volume of threats that were coming into us. And I do think that this is a concerning trend.
Secretary Bellows, you continue to serve in public office. You continue to speak your mind, in fact, running for another office. Have you ever thought, maybe I want to step away from public life because of these threats?
No. I think I feel so strongly about democracy. I mean, I was the kid that had the Bill of Rights on my bedroom wall when I was growing up. And I think this is a tiny minority of people. In fact, the person that swatted me, law enforcement, the FBI and the Department of Justice tracked him down and prosecuted him, and he's incarcerated. He was a Serbian national trying to disrupt American democracy by causing fear. And so these incidents have only strengthen my resolve. I think it's really important for those in elected office to stand up and be a strong voice and try to help us move through this period of time.
All right. Well, I know that not only do you serve as a public official, but you also oversee elections in Maine. And so you know very well what Jen has been talking about, what town clerks and poll workers are going through. What is your advice to them? What is your advice to those people who are, you know, going to be there for that June election and then again in November?
My office does training for the clerks every election. We do de-escalation training, techniques for dealing with the public. We advise clerks to safeguard their personal privacy. Unfortunately, all of us in the public sphere now have to think about what we post on social media. You know, when I first ran for office for the state Senate, I used to hand out my home address and my cell phone number on my palm cards. I knocked on 10,000 doors and everybody had my home address and my cell phone. And that's because I wanted to be accessible. Now, the advice that I have for folks is safeguard your privacy, develop strong relationships with law enforcement, and, take common sense steps to protect yourself. Unfortunately, it's very different advice than I think I would have been giving 20 years ago.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Shenna Bellows, Maine Secretary of State and a candidate for governor. Let's see here. We'll have more people calling in now. Maine State Senator Ann Carney, who is a Democrat from Cumberland County. Senator Carney, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You too faced threats last year. Tell us about what happened.
So I received an email. I got it early in the morning when I was up. It was still dark. I was preparing for my legislative day. And I opened my email and I saw an email that had the subject line, "You're going to die." And then the text of the email was quite short, said, "I'm going to kill you and all of your child raping friends."
Oh, my gosh.
And that was the email.
What did you do next, Ann?
For a little while, I didn't do anything because it was so startling and I was also concerned. I didn't know, you know, it was an anonymous threat, I thought, and it didn't say when or where this might happen. You know, when I left my house that morning, when I got to the state house, when I left the state house that night after dark. So all of those thoughts were running through my mind. And then I reported it to Capitol Police and learned that a number of other members of the committee on which I serve and which I chair had also received the threat.
How have things changed at the State House in recent years because of these threats?
I think there are a couple of big changes that have happened. One physical change is that we are getting enhanced physical security on the State House campus, and that's been really important and reassuring. And I think, as Secretary Bellows indicated, people are getting discouraged from running for office, and that has been an impact as well.
Yeah, I want to go back to the incident last year because I do understand that somebody has been arrested for that. What do we know about the person who sent that threat to you?
So he was arrested. He actually, we learned a couple weeks later that he lived in Illinois. He was a young person, an adult, but a young person. He was coping with substance use disorder and spending a lot of time online on the dark web. And he indicated that those behaviors are what got him in the frame of mind where he wanted to make this death threat. Mm-hmm. He pled guilty to the crime. And then there was a sentencing hearing in October in federal court. A number of legislators who had also received the threat, and I attended and provided victim impact statements. And that person was sentenced to 6 months, excuse me, in the Federal Bureau of Prison. And then there are other terms that kind of go along with that.
Senator Carney, how has this affected you in terms of your willingness to serve, or has it, or or things you may say publicly or votes that you may take?
It's actually strengthened my resolve to be more as do my job with as much enthusiasm and candor as I always have done. I really think that for all of us in times when we feel like we're being pushed to silence our voices, that we need to really react the opposite way and do our jobs well and do them with as much strength and integrity as we always have.
Do you suspect that others may have had the opposite, though, the opposite, instead of strengthening their resolve, making them question whether or not this is the right path?
Definitely. That has occurred to some people, and a lot of it depends on, you know, where you are in life, how old your children are, things like that, that do, you know, influence people's decision and ability to tolerate risk. And then also some legislators are much more exposed to these kind of threats than certainly I was. So it, you know, there are a lot of different factors that legislators, I think, take into account when deciding to run for re-election, and also that I think others take into account when deciding whether they want to get into a legislative role.
Before we let you go, Senator Carney, is there more that needs to be done here in Maine or across the nation to address the intimidating atmosphere?
I'll speak just to Maine because I think it's important. We have opportunities here in Maine that maybe don't exist nationally. We have a citizens' legislature, and Maine people have direct access to their elected officials in a way that is unique among the 50 states. And we need to cherish that and cultivate it and let it continue to grow, because it is what makes our legislative process so rewarding for legislators, but more importantly, it makes the legislative process so directly responsive to what our constituents and the state as a whole is asking us to do. And so I think that, you know, big picture, we do have a really engaged government here in Maine, and that we need to really protect what's special about that.
Ann Carney, thank you so much for calling in. Ann Carney, Maine State Senator, representing District 29. And another state legislator joining us, Katrina Smith, who is Assistant Minority Leader for the Maine House of Representatives. Representative Smith, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
During your time as an elected official in Maine, have you been the subject of threats?
Absolutely. Yep, I would say that is a regular occurrence in this day and age.
And how are they coming? Are they coming by email, by phone, by letter?
They are coming by on social media, social media messaging as well. By email and by phone call once in a while. And sometimes when people call by phone call, they don't even block their number. So you can, you know who's calling, and they still feel the need to reach out directly and be threatening.
What do you do when you receive these threats? How do you determine when to call law enforcement, or do you always?
I don't always. I think if it's a direct call, I always feel that someone calling you directly is really ratchets up the level of threat and the level that they feel that they can talk to you directly, yell at you directly, use words that, you know, shouldn't be used in normal conversation. I always feel like that is something that I reach out to the Capitol Police and talk to them about, make sure that they, you know if it came from a certain number, but also the number of times people call in terms of, or reach out in terms of emails, if they call or email a number of times or a couple days in a row and then a couple more days in a row, take a break and then come back. It just always, you feel the human part of it and know that maybe there's something off here and that you should notify someone about it.
Yeah. Well, the bigger question we're asking today, Representative Smith, is what does this mean for democracy? I've covered the Maine legislature in the past, and this was really not part of the conversation 10 years ago. How does this change what you do?
It definitely changes, is that I've been out recruiting candidates for this next session, and there are a number of people who do not want to be subject to this. They don't want their family to be subject to possible threats. They consider strongly, can I do this when I'm in a stronghold of where they're not going to be elected, but they still want to be on the ballot and have that part of democracy go forward. They find themselves not able to fully embrace running. And it has made people consider that. It's made people consider, do I want to stay in this when they're already serving? It's a thought that you have to have and to do what's best for you and your family.
So you definitely believe there are good people out there who could be serving their communities who are not because of this.
Absolutely. It's something that you have to take into consideration. And I'd say it's almost the first thing that people take into consideration. Do I want to put myself out there? Do I want to go through? It's not only a physical threat, but it's emotionally draining.
Yeah, I'll bet. Katrina, I'm wondering about you. You heard, I think, probably your colleague, Senator Carney, say that this has strengthened her resolve. When you receive a threat, what is your reaction? How does it make you think about the job that you're doing every day?
Well, like I said, it does tire you out at times. You really have to disconnect and make sure that you build yourself back up again or able to step back into the arena. But, you know, we have to be concerned about it. We have to make the right steps. But I'll continue on. And I've resolved, as well as she said, not to let it stop me, because I think that we all have an important words to say for our constituents, and we need to carry on and do that. And that's what we're committed to. We started this, so let's finish it strong.
Okay. And before I let you go, I'll ask you the same question I asked Senator Carney, which is, do you think there's more that needs to be done?
I think there is. I think sometimes people, when they do these things, unless it reaches the level of an immediate threat, they don't have any contact from law enforcement. I believe that there can be more of a proactive stance that law enforcement could take to at least reach out to these people and say, you know, this probably wasn't the best move. We want to make sure that you understand that, of course, you can reach out to your legislature, but these words and the way you're doing it is not the way to move forward. Just so they know someone's watching over. Sometimes they act like they're in a vacuum and no one's going to see these things. They're not going to be in trouble for it eventually if it rises to, you know, a threatening level. And I just feel like that they could be told that, you know, this is being monitored and should act accordingly after that.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for calling in. Katrina Smith is from Palermo, and she is a Republican and serves in the Maine House of Representatives. Mark Brewer, as you listen to these three people who are public servants talk about their experiences, what strikes you?
I mean, the first thing that strikes me is the gratitude I have as a Mainer that they're all still willing to do this, right? Given the threats that they face, it sounds like on a daily basis. Beyond that, I think the one thing that struck me the most is, even as somebody who studies this and is well aware of the situation, I strongly suspect we are undercounting the magnitude of what's going on here, right? That what we see is probably the tip of the iceberg. And if what we see is enough to cause us pretty grave concern, which I think it is, knowing that there's a lot more out there we don't see, probably should further increase our level of concern and try and do something about this.
And Jen, what about you?
I would say at the League of Women Voters, of course, a big thing that we're tracking within the legislature is just, what is the demographic makeup? And, you know, we have more women serving than ever before. And I noticed all of those who called in today, you know, even Secretary Bellows served in the legislature as a woman, and then Ann Carney, Katrina Smith. I just want to commend the women who step up and serve their communities, regardless of the threats that they may face. And honestly, some of these threats may be a little bit, you know, targeted based on gender. So I just want to commend those serving their communities. And it's always an honor to serve your voters and constituents. So I thank them for their service.
Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, we'd like to hear from you. What do you think is going on? How do we fix it? The phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we're discussing threats of violence against people in public service from the federal to local level. Joining me, Mark Brewer, who is a UMaine political science professor and head of the department, and Jen Lancaster with the League of Women Voters in Maine. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or call 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Ken, who's calling from Wayne. Hi, Ken. Go ahead.
Hi. There was a question brought up earlier about what can be done about this, and I believe that we are where we are with the threat of violence and violence in the, around elections because there's been a concerted campaign over the last dozen, at least, years to paint our elections as fraudulent and rigged. And I think that a partial solution could be that the organizations that are concerned about that this get together and launch a concerted campaign to educate the public about just how safe and secure our elections really are.
All right, Ken. Mark or Jen, either of you have thoughts about Ken's idea?
I'll defer to Jen since that's right in her wheelhouse.
I mean, yeah, that's very much our bread and butter. And I think we very much attempted this in the last November election when question one was on the ballot. If you recall, that would implement voter ID and it was also stripping parts of absentee voting. I think local people will start to organize and push through ideas like this that are grounded in election conspiracy theories. And the best thing we can do is to educate each other and show up and defeat these when time comes to call.
Ken, thanks for your call. An email here from Christine. One step small towns can take is to make sure they have written policies about how citizens give input and Robert's Rules of Order. This might not seem necessary when everybody knows each other, but it is in place when you need it. I recall an instance when a school board was making a decision to apply to have a school health center. Out-of-state funding paid an anti-trans agitator to attend school board meetings, be disruptive, and live stream his followers to oppose youth access to care and email school board members. The board initially was unprepared to manage such harassment. And so, Jen, what about Christine's idea that, you know, all the way down to the smallest of towns really implement policies and order in your public meetings?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a thing that we're also facing at various levels of government, which is access. People being able to join via Zoom and getting access to their officials. But I'm also curious, Mark, if you have any additional thoughts on this.
No, I think it's an important question. Obviously, a lot of smaller governmental units, you know, they tend to operate more informally at times, and that's worked for them for years. And so as the caller or the email pointed out, you know, maybe they're unprepared when things don't work and they don't have that policy in place. So I think having those policies in place for how you're going to handle various types of public input and interaction are important. At the same time, you need to balance that, you know, with accessibility, right? You know, we live in a democracy. Most of our democracy is representative, but here in Maine, we still have a pretty heavy element of direct democracy and we need to have access, right? So you need to balance access with, you know, maybe some of how that access is going to be utilized. And I think having, you know, properly designed and vetted policies in place is a good place to start.
We'll go to Torbert, who's calling from York. Hi, Torbert. Go ahead.
Good morning, Jennifer and guest. In over 60 years of political participation, there has been, let's not forget, as far as violence goes, the 60s weren't exactly a peaceful time. But the social fabric has been unraveling for a long time. We've gone from a Lockean understanding of mankind as a rational and reasonable creature to a Hobbesian perspective that life is nasty, brutish, and short. This is largely technologically driven. We're increasingly isolated from one another in our cubicles and by the nastiness of social media and our phone life. You can't walk down the street anywhere without seeing people walking with their eyes on their phone. Can't even make eye contact with a stranger now. We need to get over it and start reaching out to one another at the local level, from your neighbor to the whatever possible means of social participation, will help to rebuild the fabric of our social contract.
Torbert, thanks for your call. Mark Brewer, we heard some political philosophy in there and some sociology, but does Torbert have a point? I mean, have we changed the way we think about democracy and the way we engage in civic engagement in recent years?
I could easily go down a Thomas Hobbes rabbit hole here, but I'm not going to. I'm going to answer your question instead. And I think, unfortunately, the answer to your question is that Torbert's right about a lot of that. We do have much less interaction with our neighbors. You know, it's this whole idea of social capital, you know, from Robert Putnam and others. And when social capital declines, which it has, there's no doubt about that in American society over the last 20 or 30 years, the quality of civic life declines. And there was initially some thought that the internet would be a solution, right, to some of this declining social capital. People talked about it as, oh, we're actually going to have, you know, revival of civil society in this virtual town hall. But it hasn't worked that way. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. And it doesn't mean that we couldn't use it that way, but we certainly haven't used it that way. And I think trying to rectify this decline in social capital, this decline in the feeling of interconnectedness, is another one of the long-term solutions to this. But how we actually do that, I think, is a very difficult question to answer.
All right, Torbert, thanks for your call. We'll go to Sacco and Bob. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hello. Thank you very much. I'm just going to speak very frank about this subject that I'm passionate about. I am a registered independent. I'm old enough to have voted for Reagan, voted for Bush. I voted for Obama and Clinton. So I ride both sides of the fence. But I'm going to call this just the way I see it. Most of the presidential elections, only 60% of the people vote. That leaves 40% of the people out there that usually don't vote. When President Trump first came out on the scene back in 2015, I was interested in him. I looked at him. But when he brought in Steve Bannon, I knew he was going for the silent majority vote. I knew he was going for the white supremacist vote and the militia vote. Now, those are people that are prone to civic violence, and they have taken their civic violence and turned it into political violence. And the solution I want to offer to this is the Republican Party has welcomed these groups under their tent, and the only way to clean out this tent is to clean out most of the Republican candidates in there. I think the solution to this civic violence and political violence is to force the Republican Party to reset their values, because their values right now under this Trump administration is to court all these people who didn't vote before in previous elections because they never had somebody who felt like them. But now that they do have somebody who feels like them, they feel it's okay to get involved in the way that they're prone to get involved with.
So, Bob, are you saying that you believe some of these actions, violence and threats and intimidation that would have been taboo in the past are now normalized?
Exactly. They've been welcomed into the political rhetoric through Donald Trump and the Republican Party. Because who in the Republican Party really speaks out against this? There may be a few, but in totality, they stay quiet and they stay stepped in line because that's their new base.
Yeah, Bob, thanks for your call. Yeah, I'll turn to you, Mark Brewer.
Well, I think it's true that right now, you know, maybe the voices calling for or supporting political violence in American life are more prevalent on the right. I think it's also important to remember that there are voices on the left as well. In fact, if we look at, you know, evidence of political violence in terms of elected officials and maybe not elected officials, but high profile public figures, we see victims on both the right and the left. Right. So that's important to remember. And I think it's also important, as one of the other, I think it was a caller alluded to, you know, this has ebbed and flowed over time. You know, there's been times where political violence has been more prevalent on the right. There's been other times where it's been more prevalent on the left. I think we need to, you know, take a stand that says it's unacceptable regardless of where it comes from. I think that would be the best solution that we could have is somehow come to an agreement and then enforce that agreement that we're simply not going to tolerate violence in our civic life. It's not the way that we want to conduct ourselves. And again, I know that's far easier said than done, but I think if I could wave a magic wand and do something, that's what I'd do.
Jen, you talked about the importance of poll workers. Are there enough poll workers in Maine?
I mean, there's certainly a shortage in Maine as well as nationally. So I would highly encourage anyone who has the time and capacity to sign up and go work the polls. You know, Maine has an upcoming primary in June. And then, of course, we have the general election in November. And it's just a great way to serve your community, but also to learn a lot about what it takes to make an election happen. And honestly, it's all run by people. Like, that is the simple and quick answer. And I think it's just a great way for people to learn more about that electoral process, see what happens on the ground in action. But then you just get to hang out with your neighbors in your community all day.
And what are the qualifications for a poll watcher? Can anyone be a poll watcher? Or if somebody is coming in and saying, I don't believe this election is going to be fair, but you know, I'm going to be here to prove it. Is that somebody who would be disqualified?
Well, if we're talking about poll observation, you know, there's partisan programs out there and you could sign up to and observe the polls. If you were speaking to working the polls, just wanted to clarify, I mean, you know, working the polls, you have to take training and, you know, you learn about all the policies and procedures, but truly anyone can go in and observe the polls. But if you're going to obstruct anything, if you're going to interfere with the right to vote, like, you will be escorted out of the building. So definitely plenty of policies and procedures in place to make sure everything goes smoothly.
I want to talk to Jen. We heard, I believe it was Senator Carney, but our callers talk about increased security up at the State House. What about at polling places? Are we going to, do you believe that in the elections that are coming up in June and November, and then in the future, we're going to see more of a police presence at every polling place? And that's going to become our new reality?
I think that reality is here. In the last 6 years that we've been doing our nonpartisan election observation, we have noticed an uptick in a police presence at polling locations. And most recently, we were at the Lewiston special election a few weeks ago. As we all know, Lewiston is a traumatized community. After the mass shooting event in 2023, that community is just never going to be the same. And in that case, they want police presence. A police officer makes them feel safe. You know, they see someone there who can respond to any sort of incident. But there's some nuance here. I've also heard from voters that if I see someone who's heavily armed, they're, you know, wearing a bulletproof vest, they're in the polling location, it makes that voter think, is something wrong? Is something bad going to happen? Am I unsafe here? So I've definitely seen a perspective from two types of voters where they see, oh, there are far more police officers at my polling location than ever. And I like that. I feel safe. And others who feel like, does this mean I'm going to be intimidated at the polls? So, you know, it merits further discussion and further observation, but absolutely, there's an uptick of police officers at polling locations. And as Shanna, Secretary Bellows mentioned earlier, more and more town clerks are receiving that training on how they can work collectively with local law enforcement to be able to respond to any sort of incidences.
Mark, we just have a couple minutes left. Earlier in the program, you said we'll probably never know how many people didn't run, how many votes were cast differently than they would have been otherwise. I'm thinking to myself, this is a really difficult thing to study, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, really, it's almost like you're trying to prove a negative, right? And that's hard to do regardless of what the course of study is. The only really way you could get at this, I think, would be in-depth elite interviewing, right? You're interviewing legislators or interviewing potential candidates and asking them that question and seeing how they respond. That kind of a study is very difficult to pull off.
And you'd probably have to have confidentiality.
Yeah, absolutely. And even with all of that, I would strongly suspect, at least on the vote casting element, that people would be reluctant to be honest with that. Right. So it would be, I don't want to say it's impossible, but a study of that magnitude is daunting, to say the least.
And I think you mentioned earlier that people who are serving may not even be aware of how these threats are affecting them and affecting everything from a vote to maybe what committee they serve to choose on or which legislation they bring forward.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I'm certainly not a psychologist, but we all know that we often make decisions or take actions being impacted by things that we're not even aware of at the time, right? And it's hard to imagine an elected official who's being subjected to these kind of threats that not having an impact on what they do on a day-to-day basis in their job, whether they are cognizant of that or not.
Well, thank you both for joining us today. The voice you just heard, Mark Brewer, he's a political science professor and chair of the department at the University of Maine, and Jen Lancaster, deputy director with the League of Women Voters of Maine. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, as St. Patrick's Day approaches, we will discuss Irish history and heritage in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.